This is the VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A second official from ousted Myanmar de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy has died in custody as protests and defiance of the country's new military government continue. The Voice of Myanmar and other news outlets report that Zaw Myint Lin died Tuesday after being arrested when trying to escape from police custody in a raid in Yangon. U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to participate in an online meeting Friday with the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia, according to the White House. The first leader-level meeting of a group seen as a part of efforts to balance China's growing military and economic power. The White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki said the meeting of the Quad countries indicates the importance Biden places in U.S. allies and partners in the Indo-Pacific region. She said she expected a range of issues facing the global community to be discussed, from the threat of COVID to economic cooperation and, of course, the climate crisis. India's foreign ministry said the leaders would address regional and global issues of shared interest and exchange views on practical areas of cooperation towards maintaining a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific region. It said the summit would also cover supply chains, emerging and critical technologies, maritime security, as well as climate change. The United States is looking to strengthen ties with key allies as China takes up an increasingly assertive foreign policy approach in the Indo-Pacific region and in the world. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Queen Elizabeth says that the British royals were saddened by the challenges faced by her grandson, Prince Harry, and his wife, Meghan, and promised to privately address revelations about a racist remark concerning the couple's son, Archie. In an interview with Oprah Winfrey, Meghan accused Britain's royal family of raising concerns about how dark their son's skin might be and ignored her pleas for help when she considered suicide. Jury selection started Tuesday in the murder trial of former Minneapolis, Minnesota police officer Derek Chauvin, who is accused of killing a black man, George Floyd, in an encounter that triggered months of protests throughout the world against police abuse of minorities. The 44-year-old Chauvin, who is white, faces second-degree murder and manslaughter charges in the death last May of the 46-year-old Floyd. Floyd died in police custody after Chauvin pinned a knee on his neck for more than 9 minutes as Floyd pleaded that he could not breathe. A new study says that Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine neutralizes the rapidly spreading variant of the coronavirus recently discovered in Brazil. The results of the study were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. In another vaccine-related development, Russia's sovereign wealth fund, RDIF, has signed a deal with a Swiss-based pharmaceutical company to mass-produce Russia's Sputnik coronavirus vaccine for eventual use in Europe. The European Union has warned member states against purchasing Russia's COVID vaccine since the EU has not yet finished its review. The White House says that U.S. President Joe Biden again will participate in an online meeting Friday with the leaders of Japan, India, and Australia. Again, this is the first leader-level meeting of a group of seen as part of efforts to balance China's growing military and economic power. The Pentagon has approved the request to keep more than 2,000 National Guard troops in Washington to help protect the U.S. Capitol for 2 more months. Since the January 6th attack on the seat of U.S. Congress by supporters of then-President Donald Trump, National Guard troops have been dispatched to the grounds and tall fencing has been erected to extend the security perimeter. And China's top legislative body has formally announced plans to change Hong Kong's electoral system to ensure that only patriots will govern the island. No other details of the plans have been made public. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's Bobi Wine calls for protest against election results.
We demand that General Museveni immediately puts an end to the abduction and kidnap of our people who are taken away every day. We demand that General Museveni releases all political prisoners with immediate effect.
We may join Senegal's nationwide protest. We'll have a report on media freedom in Zimbabwe. A Cameroonian startup links patients to foreign doctors. And UN agencies are helping South Africa to end asylum seekers' backlog.
Asylum systems across the world often need shoring up, and we provide not identical support, but similar support tailored to the individual needs of the individual systems in the different countries.
And a new WHO report on physical and sexual violence against women globally. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's main opposition leader, Bobi Wine, is calling on supporters to protest January's election results and what he calls the oppressive government of President Yoweri Museveni. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
A police helicopter hovered over the National Unity Platform Party headquarters Tuesday morning. Outside the offices, several police trucks were parked, supported by military police. Over the noise, musician-turned-politician Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, called on Ugandans to take part in anti-government protests. Wine started by highlighting human rights violations and election irregularities before, during, and after the January 14th elections. He said these include arrests and detention of NUP members, torture and brutality of arrested Ugandans, and the refusal by the Supreme Court to accept over 200 affidavits, which Wine says contained critical evidence to prove election fraud against President Yoweri Museveni. It is for this reason that Wine calls on Ugandans to come out and protest.
I call upon you to rise up peacefully, unarmed, and demonstrate against a regime that has oppressed us. They've oppressed us, exploited us, and turned into slaves in our own country. The women whose sons are missing, the Ugandans who voted, and your results were shortchanged, come out and peacefully demonstrate against that impunity.
Next to Wine, as he addressed the media, were stacks of files he says were declaration forms proving he won the election. According to Wine, the forms show the NUP won the election with 54% of the vote, compared to the 35% allocated to him by the Electoral Commission. In addition to the alleged election fraud, Wine says the protests will be premised on three key demands.
We demand that General Museveni immediately puts an end to the abduction and kidnap of our people who are taken away every day. We demand that General Museveni releases all political prisoners with immediate effect. And finally, we are demanding that General Museveni immediately stops trying civilians in military courts.
In response to the call for protests, police have put all officers on standby and have told officers to enhance their visibility, enforce an ongoing curfew, and set off checkpoints to monitor people's movements, especially the youth. Lucas Owoyesigire is the Kampala Metropolitan Police spokesperson.
The organizers of these illegal demonstrations are mobilizing the public using social media and leaflets with wordings that read, "Time is now, join the nationwide protest of will not at any time hesitate to arrest and charge in courts of law anyone who will be found participating in these illegal activities."
Political analyst Godbert Mshebe says Bobi Wine's call is the right way to go, given that supporters of Museveni are, in his view, rationalizing the criminality being perpetrated by the government.
"I find it outrageous that you can have a regime kidnapping people, torturing people, killing people, and then all of us Ugandans are quiet. We are only sending out more or less like silent voices of approval."
Last week, President Museveni said he would consider the release of 50 suspects out of the 177 in detention. However, the NUP says 423 of their members are still missing and only 89 are acknowledged by the government to be in their custody. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Violent protests erupted in Senegal over the past week, sparked by the arrest of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko on a rape charge that he says is politically motivated. But for Senegalese women who endure high levels of domestic violence, the protests are also about showing solidarity for victims of sexual abuse. Anika Hamishla reports from Dakar.
Hundreds of women dressed in white gathered in Dakar Monday to express their frustrations with the government and to show support for sexual abuse victims. The event was just one of many protests that have taken place over the last week since the arrest of the country's main opposition leader, Ousmane Sonko, who was accused of raping a masseuse. He was freed on bail Monday. Senegalese President Macky Sall has been accused of arresting other political rivals on false charges since he took office in 2012. Many fear he will try to violate the constitution and seek a third term. Sall denies that Sonko's arrest was politically motivated. Katouche Diop is an actress who attended the protest. She identifies as apolitical and doesn't support Macky Sall or Ousmane Sonko. She attended the protest to fight for democracy and for the rights of victims of sexual abuse. She says the accuser is a woman, first and foremost. When you're a victim of rape, you have the right to be heard and for it not to be politicized, she says. Because the problem is, if it did not happen, then all the women who have endured abuse, they're screwed. She says all she asks is that justice is served and that people listen to the accuser. The sometimes violent clashes between protesters and security forces have shaken a nation known for its culture of peace and touted for its stable democracy. At least 8 people have died, some at the hands of armed security forces, according to Amnesty International. Several businesses have been looted. French grocery chain Auchan, which many protesters view as a vestige of French colonialism, has been a prime target. Ouhai Tiam helped organize the women's protest. She says the women are mobilized so that they can fight for justice, but they must also respect the peace, which they strongly need, she says. The unrest has continued despite Sonko's release. The predominantly male protesters are now venting their frustrations over unemployment, police violence, and the economic toll of a COVID-19 curfew at 9 p.m. local time. On Tuesday, the government pushed the start of the new curfew to midnight, with it ending at 5 a.m. Meanwhile, the woman accusing Sonko of rape has been disparaged on social media. Female protesters are hoping to hear more calls for an end to a culture of victim shaming. Diatou Sonko is a volunteer with Djegen, a women's rights organization. She says that every time a girl accuses someone of rape, people ask what she was wearing. So this dissuades victims from reporting. They think that if they report, their name will be dragged through the mud, she says. Until last year, rape was only considered a misdemeanor in Senegal. Annika Hammerschlag for VOA News, Dakar.
With COVID-19 still limiting travel, a Cameroonian startup has created a system that allows African medical patients to have an online consultation with doctors abroad. Moki Edwin Kizeka has this report from Anne Nzuanku in Yaoundé, Cameroon.
52-year-old Hassan Abakar and his wife Kumsu say they are happy to return to their hometown of Banki in Nigeria's Borno State after spending 7 years at the Minawawa refugee camp in northern Cameroon. Speaking over each other, the Abakars tell officials their youngest daughter is 4 months old. They say they had all 3 of their children at the Minawawa refugee camp, where they lived after being chased by Boko Haram terrorists from their home in Banki. The Abakar family, like most of the 342 Nigerians who chose to return home this week, received gifts of mattresses, blankets, and buckets from Cameroon's government. Cameroon Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says all the displaced Nigerians have tested negative for COVID-19 and would be socially distanced when bus over the border.
All those who are going home have willfully accepted to go back to Borno State because from every indication, things have come back to normalcy. The Cameroonian government did everything possible so that things should come back to normalcy. President Muhammadu Buhari has done everything also in Nigeria so that Boko Haram should be eradicated.
Nonetheless, some of the displaced Nigerians are apparently still wary of insecurity back home. 500 Nigerians were originally scheduled to return home this week, but only 342 followed through. Officials say only 5,000 of the 103,000 Nigerians displaced into Cameroon in the past decade chose to return to their home country in coming months, most of them women and children. 57,000 of the Nigerians have been living in the Minawawa refugee camp, while others are with host communities. Nji says there will be weekly transports for those choosing to return and they will be protected by Cameroon's military. Lawan Abba Wakilbi is a special advisor to the governor of Nigeria's Borno State. He says the former epicenter of Boko Haram has been reconstructed and is ready to receive and integrate the returning Nigerians.
As a result of the insurgency, bulk of the town has been destroyed. But for the last 1 year, serious rehabilitation effort has been ongoing by the Borno State government. So we are now ready to receive the returnees from Banki. The houses are ready to accommodate these returnees because government took special emphasis to rehabilitate the houses. They are going to live in new neighborhoods.
Wakilbe says authorities will assist the returning Nigerians with farming and to open shops so they can make a living. Some of the returnees said they were going home with cattle, goats and sheep that they had been keeping in Cameroon. The governor of Nigeria's Borno State, Babangada Umara Zulum, welcomed the returnees Monday as they arrived in the town of Banki. He says Nigeria is ready to receive all citizens who fled Boko Haram terrorism.
We remain entirely grateful to the people of Cameroon for the kind of love extended to the people of Nigeria while they are staying in the Republic of Cameroon. We have started the repatriation process. So far, so good. We have received the first batch. Thanks to the government of Cameroon. Thanks to the security personnel of Cameroon for bringing them safely to Nigeria.
The United Nations reports that 11 years of Boko Haram violence has displaced more than 2.7 million people, including some 210,000 Nigerians, into neighboring countries. And nearly 30,000 people have died in the ongoing conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Marwa, Northern Cameroon.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March 10. The United Nations High Commission on Refugee and the UN Refugee Agency have partnered with South African government to raid the country of its asylum seeker appeal applications backlog. Some of the 153,000 applicants have been waiting 10 years for their cases to be settled. Vicky Stark reports on details of the newly signed partnership agreement.
South Africa's Auditor General has warned that if nothing changes in the system, it could take 68 years to clear the backlog. Now it looks as though the authorities are definitely planning to shake things up with the launch of this Asylum Decisions Backlog Elimination Project this week. It aims to whittle down the backlog in 4 years. Pond says the project will cost $9.6 million. And that $7 million of that is coming from UNHCR. The funding will pay for 36 more staff and new computer systems.
What UNHCR does is we provide technical and financial support. This isn't singular to South Africa. Asylum systems across the world often need shoring up, and we provide not identical support, but similar support tailored to the individual needs of the individual systems in the different countries.
The project has two main objectives: clear the backlog of appeals before the Refugee Appeal Authority of South Africa and to create a new system to prevent new backlogs. Pond says those who successfully appeal are granted refugee status.
Now, a refugee is someone who has been granted international protection. They have had their claim for asylum heard, and asylum has been granted. Now, South Africa is one of the most welcoming countries in the world to refugees. They enjoy huge legal protections, and they have access to services pretty much on a par with South African nationals. Really, what it boils down to is the difference between what a refugee can do in South Africa and what a South African can do. The big difference is refugees can't vote. Other than that, it's very, very similar. They don't live in camps, they live in the community, they work, they go to school, they go to university. You know, they really can flourish here.
However, refugee status may not be permanent.
Obviously, because individual circumstances change, you know, situations in countries of origin change, if the reasons for which people fled ameliorate to the point that they can actually go home, then their refugee status can be reassessed and can be withdrawn because they can go home safely. Others become citizens.
Pond says out of the 266,700 refugees and asylum seekers in South Africa, two-thirds of them are asylum seekers. She says they're coming mostly from the African continent.
We have a large number from countries like DRC, Somalia, Ethiopia, and smaller numbers from Rwanda, Zimbabwe, and similar.
During the signing ceremony yesterday, South Africa's Home Affairs Minister, Erin Motsoaledi, thanked the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and UN Refugee Agency for their help. He said the agreement boosts South Africa's continued commitment to offering protection to people who genuinely need it. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
The Media Institute of Southern Africa in Zimbabwe has just published a State of the Media report recounting what observers say is an increasingly precarious work environment for journalists in Zimbabwe. Ade Gondo reports from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The report highlights a number of issues that concern press freedom advocates. Chief among them, the Media Institute in Southern Africa says other arrests, assault and harassment of media workers, including student journalists and newspaper vendors in the past year. The Institute says the workers were attacked for carrying out their professional duties. However, the government says its repeal of the Restrictive Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, or IPA, and the creation of the Freedom of Information Act as evidence of its media reforms. The Institute's report says the few gains made by the Freedom of Information Act have been watered down by constitutional amendments that critics say centralize power into the hands of the state president. Moreover, the report says the restrictions imposed to contain the coronavirus pandemic have been used against some journalists. Nyasha Nyakuno, the program's coordinator for the Institute, says the report focused on the operating environment for the media profession.
We witnessed a spike in the number of violations of media freedom. Mostly, the bulk of them occurred at the inception of the lockdown measures in March 2020. During the year under review, we recorded a total number of 52 journalists and media workers. That includes your vendors and media students whose media freedom and freedom of expression rights were violated during the year under review.
For instance, the report notes the high-profile arrest of journalist Hope Ochimwano, who broke a story exposing corruption in the purchasing of COVID-19 supplies. The report also points out that the Reporters Without Borders 2020 World Press Freedom Day Index ranked Zimbabwe at 126 out of 180 countries ranked globally. It contrasts that with neighboring countries such as Namibia, South Africa, and Botswana, which all ranked below 40. Nyakuno urged the government to improve the situation.
The government, including the police and other state security agents, should unequivocally condemn media freedom violations to ensure the safety and security of journalists by bringing the culprits to book in defense of media freedom and ultimately citizens' rights to free expression and access to information. On the other hand, journalists and the media as a whole should be meticulous and thorough in their work in line with the ethics of the profession, which stress the tenets of accuracy, fairness, and balance in their reportage.
Lulu Fakwa is a journalist working in Bulawayo, the country's second largest city. She says it is dangerous to work now, particularly because of her gender.
You have to make sure that you dress decently. I don't know what decent means these days, but that's what they always tell us, to dress decently.
Fakwa says that despite the repeal of laws such as IPA, much still needs to be done to change official attitudes.
They must educate their officers on the ground that they've repealed, you know, these laws. It should not just end in parliament or in the offices, but they should just educate the police and other security actors as well. This is what we're doing to promote media freedom in this country. We don't want the sleep service.
Observers from the United Nations and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights have expressed concerns over Zimbabwe's political polarization, poor governance, and growing fears of rights abuses. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
The World Health Organization reports that one in three women globally, around 736 million, suffer physical or sexual violence by an intimate partner or sexual violence by a non-partner. The study, the largest ever conducted on the prevalence of violence against women, is based on data from 2000 to 2018. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Violence often begins at an early age. The study finds one in four young women aged 15 to 24 are violently abused by an intimate partner. WHO officials say this is of particular concern, as it is during this formative age that healthy relationships are made. The report says intimate partner violence is by far the most prevalent form of violence against women worldwide. It says abusive treatment can have both short and long-term impacts on women's physical and mental well-being. Claudia Garcia Moreno is unit head in WHO's Department of Sexual Reproductive Health and an author of the report. She tells VOA problems include unwanted pregnancies and higher rates of sexually transmitted infections. She says many women suffer from mental health issues, particularly depression and anxiety, which can lead to substance abuse and other risky behavior.
It can lead to death as well, both in the form of homicide. We know that about 38% and some studies report even higher of the murders of women are committed by intimate partners. And we also see a strong association with suicide and suicide attempts.
Data show violence disproportionately affects women living in low and lower middle income countries. An estimated 37% of women in the poorest countries are found to have been physically or sexually abused by their intimate partners. Highest prevalence rates are in the regions of Oceania, Southern Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa. The lowest rates are in Europe and in Central, Eastern, and Southeastern Asia. Garcia Moreno says the prevalence of violence in intimate relationships in lower socioeconomic regions is driven by a whole range of factors.
We know that there is a strong correlation with economic development and strong stringent gender norms, discrimination against women, laws that may be unsupportive of women in terms of divorce or child custody or inheritance rights.
Garcia Moreno says countries that have organized women's movements are most successful in tackling this problem. Reducing the stigma around violence by intimate partners, she says, is critical in addressing this issue. Authors of the study report that changing discriminatory gender norms and institutions, addressing economic and social inequalities, and ensuring access to education and safe work are other measures that can help prevent violence. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Wednesday, March 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.